From your world news headquarters on the World Wide Web, it's time for your daily dose of sanity. This is the Maria Heller Show. Maria Heller is a published author, founder of the Universal Wheel, a lifestyle and philosophy based on our interconnectedness to all living things, a Reiki master, and delivers the news with spiritual views. How many intuitive news decoders, animal rights activists, and vegetarian broadcasters are there? Just one. Maria. Maria has provided independent news for a smart audience for over 13 years now on the Maria Heller Show, available at maria.net.
M-E-R-I-A.net.
And now, here is your host, the mouth that roars, Maria Heller.
Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. How's everybody doing out there? I know there's a lot of sadness in the world for the loss of Robin Williams, the loss of Lauren Bacall. A lot of people, of course, the loss of lives all over the world through war. I mean, so much craziness going on. And today I have a very special guest with me. His name is John W. James. He runs the Grief Recovery Institute. And it's a wonderful method. And today, and we're going to talk about real answers to real questions from real people, moving beyond loss, which I think all of us are feeling today on some level or another. So let me say good morning to John James. Good morning, John.
And good morning to you and all your listeners.
Thank you. It's good to have you with me. John, you yourself have a very personal story for how you got started in grief recovery.
Yeah, nobody picks grief as a topic by choice. You know, nobody wakes up in the morning and goes, oh, grief, what an idea, I think I'll get involved.
Right.
I had a son die in 1977, and you know, I'd had many other losses before that, but I had always been able to use the incorrect information that society teaches us to kind of push those losses down. But when my son died, it fell outside of that scope. And I was just stunned at the insensitivity and the lack of support and the lack of any real process to heal your heart. And so that's what got me started with the Grief Recovery Institute and the Grief Recovery Method. And that's, 37 years ago now. And the book that you're holding is actually our fourth book. The Grief Recovery Handbook and When Children Grieve and Moving On and Moving Beyond Loss are translated into about 20 languages now. And we're kind of the go-to place for people who are looking for real help, and hence the subtitle, Real Help for Real People and Real Questions and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and you know, reading through the book, you know, I could identify with so many of the questions people wrote. And, you know, I think that when you're unprepared, and I think most people are unprepared for grief, they even think, you know, is there a right way to grieve? Is there a wrong way to grieve? You know, Italian ladies, you know, they'll wear black for the rest of their lives. I think people are really at a big loss when they lose someone close to them.
Well, it's even worse than that, because all of the information that they currently have is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so that the first order of business is people to become aware, you know, that an unresolved loss is having a negative impact in their life. And then they have to begin to investigate the different myths and pieces of misinformation that are out there. And things like, for instance, oh, grief just takes time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, time alone is never going to heal anything.
Right.
The real issue is, what action do I take within time?
Mm-hmm.
And most people don't know what actions to take within time. And so hence, they just sit back and kind of wait. And it's also interesting how kind of popular media or just time itself will change one piece of misinformation to a new piece.
Huh.
Like you just mentioned, the widow may wear black for the rest of her life. But less than 300 years ago, the mourning color was white. And so people wore white. And then one of the queens of England had a loss, and she wore black. And then from that, here it is several hundred years later, and now we actually believe that black has something to do with grief, mm-hmm. which, of course, it doesn't.
Well, yeah, that's like everybody dressing up in black to go to a funeral.
Exactly. And most people don't really even know. Well, again, let's thank goodness death, personal loss, is not a common occurrence. So we only experience, you know, on average, the death of a loved one or something like that once every 9 years. Mm-hmm. So we don't really have a lot of experience with it. And so when something like that happens, that's when we look backward in time and we, oh, what do I know about this? And that's where we come up with the incorrect information that we were taught in childhood. Mm-hmm. And here you and I are talking about death, and that is always a grieving experience. But there are 44 other losses that you can experience in a lifetime that will produce grief.
Right.
And most people aren't even aware of those.
Right. Well, I'm sure there's a lot of grief if people get divorced, if they lose their job, you know, if they lose their home. I'm sure there's plenty of it. And then, of course, let's not leave out, 22 veterans every day committing suicide and the grief they leave behind.
Yeah, it is like the pebble in the pond, you know. When one person dies, no matter the cause, mm-hmm. it changes everything that is familiar in the lives of everyone who surrounds them. And so the grief just spreads out from there.
Right. Well, I often say that death is hardest on the survivors, because the person that's dead is dead. They don't know any different.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
And the other thing is so interesting is, since we don't know what to say to grieving people following a death, we tend to talk about the person who died. So, like, let's say your mother died. Someone would say, oh, don't feel bad. She's in a better place.
Right.
Which is completely true for the mother, but it is not true for the person you're talking to.
Exactly. Well, and I don't see that ever gives anybody any solace. And I know that it is very difficult. It's difficult I find it's difficult for me, not even, just because somebody's relative died or anything like that, but when something terrible happens to someone. For example, somebody close to me had a stroke. And, you know, when I first went to visit her, you know, it's hard to find the right words to say to somebody that's been incapacitated.
Well, yeah, and that might be a good place for us to start, because one of the questions we get a lot is, what should I say?
Mm-hmm.
And let me kind of back up and come at this from the opposite direction. The very worst thing that you can say to a person who is grieving, mm-hmm. whether their loss is loss of mobility, as in the case of a stroke or something like that, the very worst thing you can say is, I know how you feel.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is a physiological impossibility.
Right.
Okay? So if you simply take that sentence and turn it over, and say to people, I can't imagine how you're feeling,
mm-hmm.
and then close your mouth.
Right.
And then that gives the other person kind of the permission to tell you how they are really feeling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so when someone comes up and says, gee, my sister died and so forth, the very next sentence could be, gee, I can't imagine how painful that is. What is that like? Because the worst thing that a grieving person can do is to isolate. And by isolate, we mean not talk or tell the truth about what they're feeling.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to swallow their real feelings, because that is what we have been taught to do. The comment that I made just a minute ago about, oh, don't feel bad, she's in a better place.
Right.
is one of the 141 most common things said to grievers following a death.
Uh-huh.
And of those 141 things, 122 of them are not helpful. And that's 85%.
Wow.
And so the griever experiences a loss, and for the first day or so, they start or try to express their feelings of sadness and so forth. And 85% of the things they hear back are not helpful to the experience of grieving.
Well, what do you think? What do you think, in your expert opinion, is the reason so many of us get tongue-tied and feel so helpless when we're in that situation and around somebody? And oh my God, what am I going to say? Oh my God, what am I going to do? You know, well, we all go through that. What causes that? Because we could be the strongest person on earth, you know, 24/7, and all of a sudden we get reduced to feeling so helpless.
Well, our whole society back through history is kind of over-reliant on intellect.
Mm-hmm.
We think the answer to everything is intellectual. And so what happens is we fall back on what we're familiar with, which is intellect. So when my son died, the first sentence I heard is standing in the hallway of the hospital, it came out of the mouth of a doctor, a friend of mine, who said, "Oh, John, don't feel bad." Now, let's start right there.
God.
Don't feel bad.
Right, okay.
See? And then he went on, and he said, "Oh, don't feel bad. You and your wife can have other children."
Oh, God, I hate that.
Well, and that's one of the 141 things.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he only had 27 years of formal education.
Right.
And therein lies the problem.
Mm-hmm.
We do not teach people. We do not train people. We do not write about it. We don't talk about it, which is why I want to thank you for having this topic on your show. Grief is the most hidden issue in our society.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and as the result of that, that's why nobody knows what to say, nobody knows what to do, that kind of thing, because we are not taught. I'm when I first started doing this, I was young, and now I'm old, okay? But when I went to high school, you had to take a class in health and safety and first aid by state law.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody fell down and broke their arm, everybody would know what to do. You know, we would get a couple of sticks and we'd get a belt and so forth, and we'd make a splint and whatever.
Right.
So at some level, we were prepared for physical injury. There is not a single class anywhere on what to do or what to say when someone breaks their heart.
Of course, I mean, not.
See, think about this for a minute.
Right.
It's like if you fell down and broke your arm at work or something like that, and it was a really bad break, you would get like 6 weeks off from work. You would get full disability. Everybody would be willing to talk about it. They would even come and draw those silly little happy faces on your cast.
Right.
And no one would expect you to be as productive as you were the day before you broke your arm. Now, if your mother dies, what is the appropriate grieving period in industry for a death of a loved one?
I have no idea. I haven't worked in the work world for many, many years.
It's 3 days.
Oh, so they expect you to get over it in 3 days.
See, if you break your arm, you get 6 weeks, and everybody knows what to do. But if your mother dies, you get 3 days, and nobody knows what to do.
Exactly. Well, and yeah, when you go back to work, no one talks to you. Everybody, again, has that helpless feeling. What do I say? What do I do?
Exactly.
And, you know, it's kind of weird that we are that way, because people don't understand an emotional loss. And, you know, I would think everybody's timetable to get over an emotional loss is different, and the way they're going to deal with it is different.
Absolutely. The one truth about grief is that what we are grieving is the end of or the change in the emotional relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So it is true to say that every relationship is unique, and therefore every griever is unique.
Mm-hmm.
There are no two who are the same because they didn't have the same relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we do training seminars, you know, all over the world. And we have had, in 37 years, we've easily had 400 or 500 sets of twins who come to a training seminar.
Hmm.
Now, they both had a relationship with whoever died, but they didn't have the same relationship. Hmm. You follow what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, and so there's this incredible misinformation out there about stages of grief, as if everybody fell into these convenient little pigeonholes, and of course they don't. And so, again, what you end up with was little or no help for the people who are experiencing the loss, which is really sad because we're surrounded by loss.
Right.
I mean, day before yesterday, whatever it was, you know, my phone starts ringing. Oh, Robin Williams died.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last couple of days, it's been this giant social media thing about everybody sorry and that kind of thing, and that's all fine. And we, at our office, we can tell, even before it's announced on the media a lot of times, that some celebrity has died because our phone starts ringing.
Mm-hmm.
And while Robin Williams was very well loved and he was a big star and, you know, Michael Jackson and so forth, you would never guess in 100 years, you would never guess which person died that generated the largest number of contacts with our office over all these years.
Hmm.
And since you're never going to guess, I'm going to tell you.
Okay.
The celebrity, and Robin Williams isn't even going to come close. The celebrity who died, who created the most contacts at our office, was Michael Landon.
Wow, I remember him many moons ago.
You see, and again, it always comes down to grief, incomplete grief, is always the result of undelivered emotional communications. And in the case of Michael Landon, there were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, single moms particularly, who were using him as the adult male role model in their home. You know, every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock, they'd sit the kids down and they'd watch, you know, Little House on the Prairie or Highway to Heaven or,
right,
you know, all of those wonderful shows.
Mm-hmm.
And he was kind of like the adult male role model. And every one of those people at least once would say to us, oh, I was going to send him a note. Oh, I was going to send him a fan letter. Oh, I was going to. And then they never did.
Right.
And then he died. And then they're stuck with, gee, I wish I had done different. I wish I had done better.
Right.
You know, I wish I had sent that fan mail. And the same thing will be true with Robin Williams, who created an enormous amount of entertainment for people. He gave them, you know, like an hour off out of their life on a television show. He did stand-up comedy. He was a hilarious, funny, you know, wonderful guy.
Mm-hmm.
And because of circumstances in his life that you and I are never going to understand, the most logical, rational decision that he could make was to take his own life.
Right.
And now, whether we agree with it or whether we don't get a vote.
Absolutely. But, you know, when I look at the postings online, because I love to look at, you know, social media just to see how things land with people, you have everything from love to hate to anger And then some people blaming him, judging him. And I look at that, and it kind of gives you a look at, you know, the general public. You know, how does something like this hit them, and what causes those reactions in certain people?
Well, and if you ran it all the way back with every person who has an opinion, mm-hmm. it would be, I was going to send him a note, I was going to call him on the phone, I was going to thank him for what he has done, but I didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it will always be, because that's what incomplete grief is.
Right.
I mean...
Well, I'd love to share a story with you, John, because when I was reading your bio, I noticed you're married to Jess Walton, who's an Emmy-winning actress on The Young and Restless.
Right.
And years ago, when my mother, you know, when I was a young girl and my mother, we used to watch two soap operas together. And one of them was, it'll come to me. But one of the characters who was so beloved on the show, they kill this guy off. He was a father. He was a great guy. He was one of the most popular characters on the show, and they kill him off. My mother and I went hysterical. Okay. My poor father calls from work, and my mother can't talk because she's crying so hard. And he's like, what's wrong? And she's trying to get the words out. He knows somebody died, and now he's all upset, but he doesn't know who because she can't spit it out. And when she finally spits out, Dave Siegel died. He has no idea who that is. And, you know, we were both crying, why did they kill Dave off? You know, we were mourning for a soap opera character, so I'm sure your wife deserves her Emmy. but, you know, I just thought you'd get a kick out of that story.
Well,
One Life to Live, that was the show, One Life to Live.
Yeah, and it isn't the fact that the character died. It is the fact that the emotional relationship you had with the character died.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's the emotional relationship. If you look at relationships, they have parts. There is a physical part, and there is an emotional part. And for many, many people, there is also a spiritual part. Well, when someone dies, the only one of those that actually ends is the physical.
Mm-hmm.
See, you can't go hug them again, or you can't turn on the TV and watch them again, or whatever the case, you know, whatever kind of a relationship
right.
it is. And so consequently, the emotional relationship has to be completed so that it can change and go on.
Mm-hmm.
Because even now, you look all those years ago, you still remember the experience
Absolutely.
Of that.
Absolutely, it was hysterical. If, you know, in retrospect, it was hysterical. I mean, I'm sure my father wanted to break that TV by the time it got home from work.
Yeah. Yeah, and yet, what you were experiencing was incredibly normal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just that we've all been taught, after 3 days, it's all over, and you get on with
right.
your life, and all this foolishness. And all that incorrect information starts in childhood. You know, it starts with, well, for many people, the first loss they experience is the death of a pet.
Mm-hmm.
And the way we most handle that is, oh, don't feel bad. On Saturday, we'll get you another dog or cat or chicken or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And as if the physical replacement could replace the emotional relationship. Which cannot.
No, it's ridiculous if you think about it. It's like the doctor telling you and your wife, you know, don't worry, you can have other children.
Exactly. It's the same thing. Because what you learn, particularly in childhood, what you learn is what you practice.
Mm-hmm.
And what you practice is what you get good at. And so we practice thinking that replacing the loss can somehow heal the emotional pain.
Right.
And it isn't just the dog. I mean, stop and think back. Like you're in the fifth grade and you study really hard to get an A on the history test, and instead you get a B. And you come home and you're distraught. You're sad. You know, it's terrible. And the adults will say, oh, don't feel bad. You'll do better next time.
Right. You're just not allowed to have your feelings.
Exactly. And so people swallow their feelings because that's what they think they're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we teach people to do. And again, all of these things have a history. The topic we're talking about now, where this misinformation passes from one generation to the next, is simple socialization. Mm-hmm. It has a name, which is pass-through. This intellectual information passes from one generation down to the next. Mm-hmm. And that's how children learn it.
Right.
And so, I can remember years later saying to my mother, you know, when you said, oh, don't feel bad on Saturday, we'll get you a new dog, where did you learn that? Oh, Grandma. So I go to Grandmother. I say, Grandmother, where did you learn? Oh, from my grandma, or from my mother, you know, my great-grandmother, and so forth. And so this multi-generational pass-through of incorrect information is really the problem. And again, in the absence of any real information, mm-hmm. it just continues on.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I'm not talking too much here.
No, I'm listening. I'm enjoying it.
Well, our first book, The Grief Recovery Handbook, has now been out there for 28 years. And it is by far and away the biggest selling, most popular, best book on the topic of recovery from loss that has ever been written. And I told you earlier, I think it had been translated into 20 languages. And yet, when you look at that, we've sold less than 2 million copies of that book in a world that has 7.5 billion people in it.
Right.
So,
and all grieving. All going to grieve at some time or the other, and everybody's still at a loss to how to grieve.
Exactly. And the consequences of that are enormous. Unresolved grief, we were asked by the Wall Street Journal some years ago to do one of their world famous indexes. Mm-hmm. And so they were trying to find out if we could identify how much money unresolved grief costs industry in the United States. And so we did all the research and did all the, gathered all the information. And it was like over $76 billion a year caused by incorrect decisions that were made because people were grieving. Because the character trait that is most common to grief is a reduced ability to concentrate. And I'm sure many of your listeners identified with what I just said.
Absolutely.
I mean, in the first few days after a loss, that you even can find your way from the kitchen to the living room is a miracle.
Well, it's almost like you're in a state of shock.
Trying to read two paragraphs in the newspaper might take a half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Because your mind is wandering all over the place, your heart is broken, and the world keeps going on.
Exactly.
And so it's just one of those problems that I don't know if our society will ever be serious enough about the topic of grief to really make a concerted effort to resolve it.
Well, it's like they don't want to talk about death either. So many people are so ill-prepared for death. And they don't consider, I just recently, took care of all my legal papers, my trust, my living will, all this stuff. And when I told my son, he was like, Mom, are you getting ready to die soon or what? And I said,
he didn't want to have the conversation.
He didn't want to have the conversation. He said, wow, we're having a very grown up conversation. But I said to him, it's not that I'm anticipating dying tomorrow. I'm being responsible. I said, because when I do leave, you will have enough to do grieving, not to have to worry about all these other matters.
Yeah.
And I think that's being responsible. However, most families do not discuss death. Most people don't prepare for death. So I'm not surprised that grief is an area no one talks about either.
Yep, it's true. I mean, it's and again... we, you know, again, we're all over the world. We have, an office in Los Angeles and one in London and one in Stockholm and Perth, Australia and Mexico City and all over the place. And it seems that the people who have a real interest in helping other people will eventually gravitate to grief because it is the biggest loss. It's the biggest problem in our society. And so we have all these grief recovery outreach programs going all over the world. And matter of fact, tomorrow I'm leaving to go to New York to do another one. And, it's just, it's a huge, huge issue that we're just not prepared to deal with. We don't want to deal with it.
But still, it's part of life, and people have to deal with it. And, nobody's, my father used to say, born to die or yes to die, but we're all going to die. So you have to
be—you
got to be prepared for it. And I know you have a really great memorial website, tributes.com.
Yeah, they have a wonderful, wonderful site, and they called us up several years ago and said, "Listen, will you write a blog? Mm-hmm. Every month and so forth." And we do, and it is from that blog that we got all of the questions that are answered in the book, Moving Beyond Loss.
Mm-hmm.
And we also write a monthly article for Psychology Today and, all kinds of different, things all over the planet. And again, it's all about trying to deliver grief recovery assistance to the largest number of people in the shortest period of time. That's kind of like our mantra.
Mm-hmm. Well, and everybody needs to know what you guys have, tried and true and tested over so many years. I mean, to me, it's a gift to everybody to be educated on this. Because people tend to judge themselves,
Once upon a time, I thought about writing a book on aging parents. And then I woke up one morning and realized that I was one.
Hey, I always tell people, I've been doing this show for 15 years. I tell them I was young when I started doing this.
Exactly. See?
All right, John, we're going to take a short break. When we get back, let's talk about some of the other things that people think is correct and things people think is not correct. Because I think a hard thing is most people judge themselves, and there's no reason for that. So stay with us. John James and I will be right back. Okay, welcome back. I'm speaking with John W. James. He is one of the co-creators with Russell Friedman of the Grief Recovery Method. Their website is the same name, the griefrecoverymethod.com. I have a live link here to it. And sooner or later, we're all going to face it. John, when I first moved to Arizona, it was 23 years ago, I got hit like nobody's business, as we would say in New York. I wasn't out here more than 2 weeks when my younger sister got deathly ill and died. And within the next year, my father and my mother followed her. And I was bombarded. And I have to tell you, out of all of it, losing my sister was so unexpected, and she was younger than me. And I loved her dearly. I mean, I have five sisters, but we were very close. And I will tell you this. It took me 2.5 years for tears to stop flowing automatically from my eyes every day.
Yep.
I mean, but, I had children to take care of. I had to get set up in a whole new state. I had things to do. So, I mean, everything I did during the day, if I had to run to the store, if I was shopping for furniture, if I was preparing dinner, the waterworks were on the entire time.
Yeah,
my body functioned like a robot. But I couldn't stop, and no one judged me. And maybe they were afraid to.
Yeah, well, that might be good.
But I had no problem flailing and throwing myself against the wall and just going crazy, for as long as it took to get all of that out of my body.
Well, it's very interesting. Tears are very, very important. It's one of two ways that the human body has to remove negative chemicals and negative energy out of the body. And yet, even that, crying is frowned upon in our society, even though it's healthy.
Well, I had no problem crying. Believe me, people were almost afraid to approach me wherever I was because the tears just kept coming. And, you know, after a while, you know, they started to subside. And then, you know, what took their place was what I used to call quick and instant little thunderstorms, where I could be in the middle of doing something and all of a sudden I'm having a total breakdown and crying like nobody's business for about 3 seconds or 5 minutes. And then it would pass. You know, but I allowed myself to feel, you know.
And see, that's the most important part right there. You allowed yourself the right to have normal and natural reactions to a tragedy.
Mm.
And that's what it was, you see. And so whenever we don't allow ourselves to do the thing that is normal and natural, then we are going to pay a price. And as a society, we do. I mean, if you watch little children, they process whatever feeling they are having in the moment they have it.
Right.
They don't store anything.
Mm-hmm.
See, and that's the way we're designed to be as human beings. We're processing units. And yet everything around us teaches us that we should convert and become trash compactors, which is not very good for human beings.
Right. Well, you know, when I was a kid, you talked about, you know, people learn what they see growing up, you know, from your parents to your parents' parents, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I was of age enough, you know, when my mother's parents died, I was 11. And we lived in the same building. So I watched, you know, and then of course we were Italian, so the drama was extremely high. You know, looking back, I mean, nobody beats Italians for drama. You know, I remember my aunts, my uncles, you know, coming and then throwing themselves on the floor, you know, stomping their feet like they were five-year-olds, you know, really wailing and crying.
Right.
And, you know, by the time my dad's parents died, I was probably 12 or 13. You know, I remember my father sitting at the table crying openly. You know, he had no problem expressing his emotions. You know, I remember, you know, sitting on his lap trying to comfort him. And he just kept crying, you know, and saying wonderful things about his parents and how he was going to miss them and how much he loved his mother. And it was very interesting for me as a child to see that. Because, you know,
it was very good and healthy for you to see that, because what you're talking about is normal.
Well, I hurt for my father to watch him that way, but I also knew, you know, it gave me the courage or the, I guess, permission to react the same way when he left the planet.
Exactly. And that's perfect. It's just, see, again, because there is no premium placed on the expression of sadness, we tend to hide it and then swallow it. And there's nothing that you can do worse for you than that.
Right.
Now, and again, sometimes, you know, you have to kind of control it a little bit. I mean, you can't start crying in the middle of driving the car on the freeway and so forth.
No, you can't. It's time to pull over.
But you certainly can when you get home. And it's just, people just don't do that because we're trained not to.
Right.
Literally trained not to do that.
Well, we live in a society here in America, if you think about it, where men are not supposed to cry.
Oh, heavens, no.
And I think that's such a terrible thing because, you know, look at the men in our society. You know, they live a role.
There's this thing. But now, again, I don't want you to think that it's 100% a man issue, because if you remember the song in the 60s, it was "Big Girls Don't Cry." So
that's right.
We're pretty equal opportunity about that.
Right. Well, you know, I remember a personal story when my son was young, really young, maybe two or three. It really bothered my husband that my son was so sensitive and would cry at the drop of a hat. It bothered him so much that when we went to the pediatrician, my husband complained to the pediatrician about it as if there was something wrong with my son because he was raised to never show his emotions.
Yeah, exactly.
And I remember my pediatrician, who was a man, saying to him, well, that just means he's a sensitive man and the world could use more sensitive men. So it was surprising that he didn't take my husband's side, which I was pretty happy about. Because we so many people, and I know it's programming and family background and culture and religion that teaches them, you know, maybe it's not polite to cry, you know, in public or, you know, show your emotions.
Yeah. And it's, you know, again, it's learned behavior because we learn from observing. Mm-hmm. And we're probably never going to change that. I mean, there was a study done up in Canada some years ago where they tried to identify the number of times that a child received the message that showing sad feelings was not okay. And that was between age 4 and 15, or the 11 most formative years. And there were 23,000 reinforcements that a typical child received that told them to not show sad feelings. And you know what's really funny? The only place that it is appropriate, or nobody says anything about it, to have sad feelings displayed on television is after major sporting events when one team loses.
Wow.
Isn't that interesting?
That's crazy. But I've seen it myself. Believe me, I've seen it myself personally when your team loses and everybody's a little crying and suicidal. But we get all up and excited about things that don't matter, and then, you know, your mom, your dad, your son, your daughter, you know, your aunt could die, and everybody's like, you know, what should I bring to the potluck? And nobody wants to talk about it.
Yeah, nobody wants to talk about what happened.
And you talk about an elephant in the room. You know, when I was a young girl, you know, and you're admitting to being old, so I'm going to assume we're in the same baby boomer class. If I don't know about where you grew up. But in the neighborhood I lived in, people were, they had their funerals at home.
Oh, yes.
In the parlor, okay? That was before funeral parlors replaced the parlor and turned the parlor into a living room.
Yep.
You know, you would have the body in a box right there in the living room or in the parlor, and the whole neighborhood would come. They even had a signal on the doors of people's homes, which was a corsage, which let everybody in the neighborhood know that somebody had died there.
Yeah, it's interesting. The very first funeral that I ever went to was for my grandfather. And I can remember they had to take the front casement window out of the house in order to get the casket in.
Hmm. Right, so you remember those days too, but people did grieve more openly in those days, and maybe the whole fact of taking the body and somebody dying in a hospital instead of at home puts more mystery around the death and stuns people into not grieving as much because they're not there to witness it.
Well, and that is part, and another part is, as sad as this is, hospitals are very, very, I don't know what word to use here.
Cold.
They don't want there to be tears in hospitals. They don't want to acknowledge that someone died. Mm-hmm. If someone dies in the hospital, in less than 30 minutes, they'll have that body is moved, it's down in the morgue, it's...
Well, it's bad for business.
Yeah, well, or they see it as a failure of some kind. I'm not sure what, but so in this process, we just make it more and more difficult for people to be normal.
Right.
I mean, I don't want to take up too much time here with complication, but in the new DSM-5, the desktop diagnostic manual that doctors and therapists and everybody uses, for years, grief had an exception. It was outside of medical and psychotherapeutic diagnostic stuff. Mm-hmm. And in the new DSM-5, they've come up with this new thing where if your husband or your wife die, if someone dies, and you are sad more than 2 weeks, you have had a major depressive episode and you're sick.
Right, I'm sure they have a pill for that.
Oh, isn't that Yes. Isn't that their answer for almost everything?
Absolutely. But, you know, the answer is be a human being. You know, your feelings are always right. Whatever they are, just feel them. Because numbing those feelings is not going to make anything any better. You know, I've seen that my whole life.
Yeah, it's true. And yet you'll have, I mean, there are people listening right now who have been swallowing sad feelings for 20 or 30 years. And they don't know what to do. They still do not know what to do. And so I would tell them to go to our website, thegriefrecoverymethod.com. And up at the very top, there's a little button that says helpful articles and that kind of thing. And all of this stuff is free. Mm-hmm. You know, they can go and read or download or do whatever they want to do. Or go to the library and get a copy of the Grief Recovery Handbook, or get a copy of Moving Beyond Loss, which probably has the very questions
in it. You didn't miss any of that. Right. It seems like you covered every type of grief you could in that book, because I read it and I was identifying with so much of it on so many different levels. But you know what? This is also a good idea, because when people, as we said earlier, we start to feel helpless. Well, imagine having the Grief Recovery Handbook when one of your friends loses somebody close to them, and all you have to do is show up, knock on the door, hand them the book, and leave.
And we've had people do that.
I'm sure. I'm sure of that.
Yeah.
I remember one of my neighbors who was a nurse at the time that I was grieving over, who knows what, she probably heard me screaming and wailing through the doors. And she just rang my bell, and I opened the door, and she handed me some Valium and just ran away.
Yeah, and it's interesting. The Valium would have short-term effect or short-term relief.
Right.
But no long-term benefit whatsoever.
No, I was enjoying wailing and flailing, but I guess I was scaring the crap out of my neighbors.
Yeah. It's a strange world we live in when normal is somehow treated as if it were abnormal.
Exactly.
You know, and again, it's not, nobody's doing any of this because they're mean or evil or anything. It's lack of knowledge. They just simply don't know what to do or don't know what to say.
Absolutely.
And this is everywhere. This is family, it's friends, it's funeral homes, it's hospitals, it's churches, it's, you know, this misinformation is just everywhere. And it, you know, and again, the proof that we are human still is that we are affected by these things like celebrity death or, you know, all of the mayhem that's going on in the Middle East and in the Ukraine and all of these things. We do have feelings about other people who are having problems.
Absolutely. And, but I mean, even if you look at the media, and I'm sure that you do, even when people come out and speak their truth, the media will tell them they're wrong and they're not experts and they should shut up. Okay. So it's like you're damned if you do and damned if you don't.
Yeah, it's kind of funny in a really sad way.
It is. It's very messed up, because what makes us human seems to be becoming diseases, you know, instead of encouraging people to let it out, you know, let it all out. You know, my friend with the stroke, she told me she's depressed. She started crying. Then I could see she was trying to hold back her tears. And I said, you have every right to be depressed. You have every right to be crying. Let it out. You know, but how many people are going to do that? I saw my friend who visited her with me. He immediately made a U-turn and walked out of the room.
Yeah.
You know, and I was there and said, you don't have to be happy about this.
And everything is treated as if it were a disorder today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I'm a former Marine and a Vietnam guy and the whole thing. And I had post-traumatic stress disorder before there was post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right.
Now, guess what I really had?
I would say.
I was a griever.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean?
Right.
And so even now, we have we consult with the Department of Defense and all these things now, because they're kind of starting to wake up, which is a little late, but better late than never.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, it's just the same problem we've been talking about the whole time. The issue is lack of knowledge. The issue is there are, now keep in mind, we're grieving about the end or the change of an emotional relationship.
Right.
And so in order for people to identify what is unfinished, they need a process by which to kind of investigate.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the Grief Recovery Handbook and When Children Grieve and the other books that are a bit more prescriptive, okay, there's a whole process. You know, it really just tells people, here, do this, do that, do this other thing, and the result will be that you will become aware of the of this information. And then you have a starting point from where you can take some action that will heal your heart.
Exactly.
And I, you know, I mean, if we would just start teaching all this stuff to everybody in the sixth grade, we'd be a whole lot better off.
Oh, I agree. You know, I have a friend who's constantly telling me I'm depressed. And I look at her and I said, you know what? Maybe you're not really depressed. Maybe you're just sad.
Yeah.
I think the words we use convince us, and we hear those words from the medical practice. You know, if you're depressed, take this pill. If you have anxiety, yeah, take this pill. You know, when we were kids, you were happy or sad, okay? And nobody said, oh, this child needs drug therapy, okay?
Well, yeah, we do seem to be a little...
Why can't we go back to happy and sad?
Well, see, here's the problem. You're making sense now.
That is a problem.
Yeah, and that, too, is in great short supply in the world we live in. So, mm-hmm. I don't know.
Well, but you do know, to me, everything in this world is love or fear. And I think we have so much fear thrown at us that we forget how to love ourselves and love other people and even love, you know, ourselves, warts and all, you know. Oh, I cried. Big deal. You know, get waterproof mascara next time. It's okay.
And I so agree with what you say. I mean, it is love or fear. And if we're a little wrong in our definition,
mm-hmm.
Okay, then we have all kinds of problems, and that's pretty much a description of the world that we're living in right now.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well,
John, I got to tell you, your book was absolutely excellent, and I'm looking forward to reading your other books.
All right. Well, I came a little late to the party. Yeah, send people to the website, and they got a whole bunch of free stuff there, and we're just trying to help people.
Well, that's a great thing. You know, I think what you do is way more important than somebody getting a prescription or being told, you know, it's been a week, get over it.
Exactly.
Okay. Thanks so much for joining me, John.
Thank you, honey.
My pleasure. Bye. John W. James. There's nothing to be ashamed of, as my teacher Sunbear used to say. Tears are moving water, and moving water is always healing water. And that's today's show. I hope it helped you guys out. Check out his websites, and I will see you guys tomorrow when I'm back with the news. And again, thanks for supporting the show.